Holden Karnofsky, you all know Holden. Of GiveWell, you all know GiveWell.
Wow. I don't hear that very often.
All right. Well, Holden, quality back.
Thanks. All right, guys, thanks. So I'm going to talk a little bit, but my preference is for Q&A. I enjoy that more. You guys probably enjoy that more. So I don't know exactly how long I'm going to talk, but probably I'm going to go through the history of GiveWell, kind of how we've evolved over time, where we stand now, how we evaluate ourselves, and then I'm going to leave the bulk of my time for Q&A because I think that'll be more interesting. It sounds like you guys already are somewhat familiar with the organization. So so GiveWell got started in 2007, or actually as a part-time organization in 2006. And it was a pretty simple situation. I was at a hedge fund. I was making a lot of money, certainly for my age and marital status and all that. And I was trying to figure out where I could give it to charity, and just had a very kind of normal, for me, reaction of, well, whenever I shop for a major purchase, I want to get the best deal for the least money. So with my charity, how can I help the most people with the least money? And as you guys could probably guess, it was really shocking how hard it was to do this, how poor the information was out there. So, I got my friends together to help me, and at one point there were eight of us. We were all working at the same hedge fund. We were borrowing the conference room every couple of weeks to get together and kind of be a support group and say, well, one of us was looking into clean water in Africa, and I was looking into education, and, different people were looking into different things, and we were sharing what we found. So at that time, we kind of looked in three places for information on how to do as much good as possible with your giving. The first place that was natural to look was sites like Charity Navigator. That's the first thing that comes up when you type in charity. And we were certainly interested in the 1 to 5 star ratings, but it quickly became apparent to us that these sites were only looking at tax returns, essentially. They were looking at how charities spend their money in terms of program, administrative, fundraising. And that to us, was even potentially counterproductive, because I think a lot of times to do really great work, you need to spend a lot on admin and maybe on fundraising too. But also more to us, it was just kind of beside the point. I think we were asking questions like, I'm trying to help people learn better. Should that be tutoring? Should that be, extra classes? Should that be interventions that don't even directly address education? Like, what actually works here? And to say, well, we spend 90% of our money on programs and 10% on admin, A, doesn't tell you very much. B, it's like also true of organizations like the U.S. Golf Association. So it's just not a very helpful fact. So we quickly noticed that. A couple other places we tried to talk to foundations. Because that's a very logical place to look, because foundations are giving away a lot of money and they have full-time staff. And unlike Charity Navigator, the staff job is not to rate every charity in the world, it's to figure out where they should give to fulfill their mission. But that really didn't go well, because foundations just publish really little information about what they're doing. And the information they publish tends to be kind of PR materials. There's very little substance to it. A lot of them were just hard to even get into a conversation with, and usually the most we got out of foundations was something like, have you guys checked out Charity Navigator? The third place we looked was charities themselves, and we would call charities, and we would kind of just ask the toughest questions we could, which frankly maybe weren't the toughest questions because we were very new to this. And that was when we really started to feel like something was up here, because it sounded like we were asking questions like, what do you do, and why do you think that it works, and do you have empirical evidence on this? And we were just getting the impression that the charities had never heard these questions. That it was almost like we were from Mars or something sometimes. There was one group where I was asking them for a breakdown of their expenses by region of the world, because I had kind of given up on getting information from them about how their recipients, how their standard of living was, but I thought I could get it independently. And so I was asking for this information, and I was accused of spying on them for another charity. They got in touch with my boss and like tried to get me fired, and it was really, they didn't succeed. Like, I started GiveWell on purpose, but it was a really strange experience. And at a certain point, we kind of, Ellie and I, who are two of the eight people, kind of noticed that we were really interested in these issues. We were kind of thinking about them a lot harder than we were thinking about the bond market. We were not getting very far. We thought we could get further if we were full time. And we kind of, you know, we're seeing a big gap in the ecosystem. And at that time, we were kind of asking the question, well, maybe this doesn't matter. Maybe all that matters is that the really big funders know what they're doing. But, you know, when we did a little research, we saw, and probably you guys know this number, that, you know, individual givers give about six times as much as all foundations combined in the U.S. And sure, some of that is church, but it's a similar picture when you break it down as we were able to break it down. And it really shows you that, you know, it showed us that there's certainly a big problem here. Whether we can make a lot of progress on it remained to be seen. And frankly, I think our belief that we could make a difference wasn't necessarily very well thought through or defensible, but we were really interested in what we were doing. And what we did is we basically quit our jobs and we told our coworkers, hey, you know, we're starting this thing. We need startup funds to make it work. And we raised about twice as much money as we needed for operations. And we used the rest as grants. And a theme that's come up again and again, and this is the theme where we kind of started, is that you get much better information when you're taken more seriously, and you're taken more seriously when there's more money behind you when talking to a charity. And so when we were originally calling up saying, well, I'm a donor, I don't really know how much I'm going to give, we didn't get very good information, and we thought we could get better info by saying, hey, we have a $25,000 grant. Do you want to apply for it? And we did it that way because we didn't think we could prove that our ratings were going to drive money, and so we figured we should have the money up front. So that was back in 2007. That's how we started. Since then, we've evolved a lot. You know, what we did for, I'd say, our first 4 to 5 years is we really focused on what I'd call traditional GiveWell, which is looking for charities that are proven and cost-effective and scalable. And so it's the kind of deal where you can say, if I give, you know, $2,500, I'll be able to buy this many bed nets, and in expectation, I'll save one life. It's kind of the simplest possible form of charity to evaluate, and that's why we picked it, is because we thought we'd be able to get somewhere on that and come out with meaningful recommendations and get to the next stage. So that was what we did for 5 years, and we still do some of it. And our process evolved a lot, but that's kind of, that's where we've mostly been. And right now, our number one charity, the Against Malaria Foundation, I think really exemplifies this kind of giving. They distribute bed nets. That's one of the most proven ways to help disadvantaged people that exists. They're cheap. We estimate $2,500 roughly per life saved. That estimate has all kinds of issues with it, but it's the best we can do. And I think, you know, both that and the simple observation that a bed net costs $5 and lasts for years and covers more than one person, I think show that it's, you know, we've got a lot of evidence, it's strong on cost effectiveness, and we understand the funding situation of both the global malaria control community and of the Against Malaria Foundation pretty well. And we can say that when you give your dollars there, it means more bed nets and it means some number of more lives saved. Another thing that Against Malaria Foundation has going for it is their incredible commitment to transparency, because we can't have this information from most charities. It's just the information we need to be able to assess them is not there. They're not used to answering these questions. Against Malaria Foundation and our number two charity are both really models of just giving you whatever you want to know. Everything's out in public. And I think that's really unusual, and it allows us to kind of do charity updates in which we really learn how things are going. And when there's bad news, we get that, and we publish it, and we have. And when there's good news, we get that. And it creates a kind of a feedback loop that I think most givers don't have and has been really educational for us. So that's kind of, you know, roughly where GiveWell has been. In terms of where GiveWell is going, I think probably a lot of people would know this, but we're looking now beyond that area of proven cost-effective interventions, and there's a few reasons for that. One is that we don't believe, and didn't really ever believe, that this kind of charity is the only way to have a positive impact or the best way to have a positive impact. And I think we're reaching the point where we're kind of able and ready to look into other areas and come up with frameworks for evaluating other areas, so we want to be doing that. Another reason that we're branching out is because in the course of building this organization, looking at these types of charities, we ran across Good Ventures, which is a major foundation. It's funded by one of the Facebook co-founders, and they really liked the way that we think about charity, and we worked with them a fair amount. And basically, we were thinking about how do we serve a group like that? And it looks very different from serving a bunch of people who want to give $1,000 and kind of know conceptually what that $1,000 does. And it's a much more open field. There's a lot of things you can do as a large staffed foundation that you can't do as an individual with just some money and not very much time on your hands. And so we wanted to be able to help them. We wanted to be able to help other organizations like them, major givers. And we wanted to just find the best giving opportunities possible, not just the best that fit within our predefined framework. So that's what we've started is this initiative called GiveWell Labs. And that's kind of our term for just experimenting and branching out and trying to cover the whole world of giving opportunities and find where we would give and actually where we do give to do as much good as possible. GiveWell Labs, I think, has been a little tough to get off the ground because there's just been a lot of communications and back and forth around how much of our time goes to GiveWell Labs versus GiveWell Traditional. And so we kind of formally launched in 2011, but I would say this is the first calendar year, and it's been pretty much this calendar year that we're really saying this is our priority. This is where the vast majority of our resources are. This is where we're putting our time. And another piece of that picture is that we feel we're reaching diminishing returns to some extent on the traditional work. So, you know, we've covered, I think, the landscape of proven cost-effective, scalable charities fairly well. I'm not going to say 100%. And we have a sense for what's out there and what could be out there. And so, you know, we largely feel that the returns to putting a lot more effort into that wouldn't be very high. We can keep that up to date while significantly branching out. And so then, you know, the next kind of question is, what are we doing to branch out? And how are we tackling this much bigger, more intimidating question of just what should I do with my money to accomplish as much good as possible? And, you know, certainly one thing we've observed very early on is that this question and the way we're asking it is not a question that is being asked by a lot of people. And it's a question that a lot of people are even kind of uncomfortable with. And I think probably the people in this room are an exception to this. But when, you know, when we talk to a major foundation or a major philanthropist, what's your advice? What's the best cause? What should we do to have the most impact? You know, a lot of the answers we get are, well, you have to start with what you're passionate about, and you have to start with what you care about and what you're, you know, personally interested in. And then, and what you have to do is take that and pick a cause. And then once you pick a cause, you can kind of hire people who are well-suited to that cause and explore that cause and get into it, and then you'll find the opportunities. But there's kind of no answer to what the best cause is. And I think I understand why people give that answer, and I think part of it is just that it's really hard to look across causes. It's hard enough really to look within a cause when you're this unconstrained and find the best giving opportunities. And it can take years and years, and it's kind of long beyond the time frames that most philanthropists expect when they get involved. So, you know, I understand the kind of feeling, which kind of mirrors our early feeling, to take this giant problem and just bite off a somewhat arbitrary segment of it that you feel like you can chew. But that said, I mean, I think we do have the informational resources to do a much better job if we start asking this question, you know, across all the causes. What causes should we work on? What problems should we be interested in? So we kind of call that endeavor strategic cause selection, and that's our main focus right now. And I would say that we've shifted our analysis a lot where we don't, when we're doing this GiveWell Labs work, we don't really think of the charity or the project as the main unit of analysis. We think the first thing we probably have to do is pick causes that make sense to be in, then get to know the causes really well, and only then will we have the context to really evaluate charities and projects intelligently. And we've written several blog posts about this, and I'm happy to go more into that idea, because I think I found this idea a little counterintuitive at first, but that's where we are. In terms of what we're literally doing, there's, you know, we have a long list of causes that we think could be promising, and we're investigating them at different levels of depth. So we have what we call a shallow investigation, which is like talking to a few people, reading a few papers, writing up where we stand about what the problem is, what some possible interventions are, how much money is attacking the problem on the philanthropic side. And then the idea is to take a lot of these shallow investigations and compare them and pick a smaller set of causes to do deeper investigations of and to keep winnowing the field that way. So that's kind of the plan and the framework. Operationally, it looks a little different because we want to be doing these medium and higher depth investigations right now because we want to start learning about how to do them right now. And so we've already done kind of a medium depth investigation of the open science cause, which is kind of in some ways was picked because we happened to bump into enough places that we felt we had traction. But the reason we did that is because we want to start the process now of thinking about what kind of person is able to do this, how do they need to be trained, and when we get to these medium depth causes, how are we going to do them? So that's a lot of the work we're doing is, you know, the shallow investigations, the medium investigations, and they're all targeted at these questions of how big, how important is the problem, how tractable is the problem, are there things we can do about it? And three, who's already in this space? Who's already working on this? And our ideal is to find causes where there's something really important and tractable going on, and it just doesn't get as much attention and as much philanthropy and as much money as, you know, other causes of comparable importance. Another thing that we're doing on the GiveWell Labs front is there's a bunch of issues that we feel cut across all causes that we're trying to kind of study, because we think they're going to have implications for a lot of the different things we do. So one issue is understanding political advocacy and what role philanthropy can play in that. And there's, you know, there's a lot of causes that you will understand a lot better if you understand these basic nuts and bolts of what political advocacy groups do, what the different kinds of groups are, what the history of philanthropic involvement in it is. Another area that cuts across a lot of things is scientific research. So right now we've kind of, you know, we've started with the segment that we're calling biomedical research, and we're trying to basically get a sense for what it takes to investigate good science, what it takes to understand what good science is and how to invest in scientific research, which again is like, it's a whole category that breaks down into a lot of other causes. Another thing we're trying to do is understand who the foundations are that are out there, the big foundations. We've done a fair amount of work trying to write down like what they do, how much money they spend, what they're like. We're also trying to get to know them more qualitatively. And, you know, this is one of many areas in which having good ventures as a partner and being able to point to, you know, numbers and money behind what we've done is really essential, because I think, you know, especially in this case, without good ventures, I mean, I think we've had trouble getting real audiences and honest conversations with big foundations, and now it's going a lot better and it's a lot easier. And we're learning a lot about not just how much they have and what their website says, but kind of how they're thinking and how they're not thinking and what they might be missing. And then a final cross-cutting area is history of philanthropy. And this is something that I think, you know, I've really been stunned by how little you can find on the history of philanthropy. We're still looking, but we want to ask, I mean, what have philanthropists done? We talk to lots of foundations that say, well, you know, we don't believe in solving symptoms, we believe in root causes, because if you can influence government policy, then that's so much more effect. And we're like, yeah, if. So, you know, has it happened? When has it happened? How has it happened? Where have foundations had the most success, and how have they done it? And this is something that just, there's not a lot of information out there. We did run into a guy who is really interested in this topic, and we're kind of working with him as a contractor, and right now he's just like going through all the literature and helping us understand what is out there, so that if we try to create more, we know where to fit it in. But that's definitely a really important cross-cutting issue. So that's basically what we've done and what we're doing. I'm also going to go through just, I think, some basic principles that I think are really core to our organization. One of the big things that I think sets GiveWell apart is breadth, just looking at lots and lots of different options and considering them all. I think, as I said, this is something that's really rare among the big foundations, which tend to kind of pick their causes based on personal interests or passions. You know, this is a general theme I feel is that in the philanthropy world, you just have a lot of people taking shortcuts, because it seems like a big intimidating problem. So you have people on the foundation side, you know, kind of saying, this is what we're interested in, this is what we're doing, and robbing themselves of the chance to do strategic cause selection. Frankly, I also think this problem exists in parts of the effective altruism community. I think that some of the emphasis on astronomical waste is also a shortcut. I think it is, you know, I think you've got a problem any time that you reach a confident conclusion about which subset of the philanthropic space is the right subset to be in, and the process that arrived at that conclusion didn't involve much investigation, didn't involve much going out and looking at the world, asking who's working on what, asking what the possible solutions are and what things look like. And so I think I see some of that symptom, you know, without you know, necessarily thinking it's universal in any way. I think that's definitely something we see. So, I mean, a really core value for us is breadth and is just not not giving into that temptation to focus in on one thing, but instead keeping ourselves open to a lot of things. Another principle of ours that's really important is cost effectiveness. I think probably you guys are mostly familiar with that. We definitely want to get the most out of every dollar. We think that, you know, the argument that something does good is really not enough, and we think that doing good with your giving is not enough. We think that doing as much as good as possible per dollar is kind of what we're after. We also have a principle, I think, of self-skepticism. So we believe it's easy to tell yourself a story and to become very convinced of it and to kind of go off and commit to it. And I think we put an unusual amount of effort into examining ourselves, asking what could be wrong, and really putting the scrutiny on ourselves that I think most philanthropists don't put on themselves because they don't have to and because it can be painful. So those are very important values to us. And then our final, I think, most important value is transparency. And this is the one thing that I feel like has just been rock solid from day one of GiveWell, because our vision of ourselves has evolved a lot. And a lot of the things we used to think were kind of core values have turned out maybe not to be such core values. But transparency, I think, has just been a constant. I think this is a sector where there's not a lot of good reason to keep a lot of the information behind closed doors that people are. And, you know, maybe our methodology still needs a lot of work, and maybe a lot of the ways we're thinking about things are totally wrong. But I think for philanthropy to operate better, you need to see a more serious conversation happening out in public. And, you know, if our ideas are wrong, we need to be seeing more people with other ideas explaining what they mean. So a lot of what we're trying to be is a model of how to do philanthropy in a way that considers the learning you do as you go to be a public good and shares it with the world. And I think, in general, it takes many years to learn how to do good philanthropy. I think that's been universal with the foundations we've talked to. And so for that, for them to be not making the effort to share that, I think it's a real mistake. So those are kind of our most important principles. In terms of how we evaluate ourselves, I think people should be aware of kind of our money moved metric. That's one of the main metrics we use to gauge our progress. So money moved is the money that's given to charities or giving opportunities we recommend on the strength of our recommendation. So it's only money we can confidently attribute, and usually the way we attribute it is either that it was like a click through our website, like click this button to donate to this charity, or it was a personal conversation with someone who's like, yeah, I gave because GiveWell told me to give here. And so, you know, that's a number that we use to kind of gauge our influence. And in 2012, the total was about $9.6 million that was given on the strength of our research. And of that, about, thanks. Yeah. So of that, about $3 million was from Good Ventures, and about $6.5 million was from individuals. A large number, not a huge number, but a large number of individuals. And that number has been growing at a good pace over time, and, you know, roughly doubled every year. And we hope it'll keep going up at that pace. That would be great. And when we look at this number, you know, I think this number is really important for a couple reasons. One, it's just hopefully it's money going to good causes, good charities, doing more good there than it would do otherwise. But another is I really see this money move figure as somewhat of a banner of the effective giving movement. You know, when you talk to a charity, it matters a lot how much they think you matter. And if there's a lot of people out there saying, well, I want a good story, I want something that kind of, you know, has good marketing materials, I want to go to a fancy fundraising event, and those are the people where all the dollars are coming from, then we're going to have one dynamic, and it's going to look a lot like today's dynamic. But if you have a large chunk of money that's coming from people that are saying, please, enough with the glossy brochures, enough with the generalities, like, what I want is substance, and also I'm ready to listen to shortcomings and to failures, what I want is just the real story, then I think you can see things change very broadly. And I am in fact optimistic about this number going up, and I'm optimistic more generally about effective giving becoming a bigger thing. You know, what we see our role as is not just directing money to our top charities, but as being kind of a hub for intelligent discussion around effective giving. We're seeing ourselves as a place to start and then a place to push back on and to argue with and to critique. And, you know, I'm leaving time for Q&A because I want you guys to do that, and we like that. And I'm really optimistic about the size of that pie going up, because I really do think effective giving, I mean, it seems to me like a very intuitive idea. I'm somewhat surprised more people aren't into it today. But I also, you know, I think there's an argument that there are trends that have been happening that can explain the rise in effective giving and then can predict a further rise in effective giving. I think very broadly speaking, the world is getting wealthier and it's getting more unequal and it's getting more interconnected and better informed. And so one of the things that I found interesting is, you know, when I'm going back and trying to learn about the history of philanthropy, it's often the case that the like biggest foundation was pretty good. So the Rockefeller Foundation, I feel like, thought about this stuff somewhat in the way we think about it, really looking across all causes, being open to anything they could do. And I think it's possible the reason for that is that they kind of feel this sense of responsibility that comes from saying, wow, like, we really, you know, we're the ones who can do this. And if we don't step up, no one else is going to. And we have this amazing amount of money. But I think what's going on today is that people are getting the informational resources to realize that a lot of us are kind of metaphorically in that position that the Rockefeller Foundation was in a while ago. I think today there's a lot of people who, you know, may have previously been considered or may be considered by others to just be sort of normal middle-class people. But when you start comparing your life situation and your living standards to the past or to the rest of the world, you realize that you're actually, you have a huge amount of resources and a huge amount of power and a huge amount of information. And there's people who have much less of these things. And you can find them. And you can understand things about them. And you can find ways to help them. And that's all within your power. So I think, you know, this combination of wealth and inequality and interconnectedness, all these three things are increasing. And so I really do, I hope it, but I also believe that we're going to see a world in which more people are kind of coming up with this realization. Wow, I'm really fortunate, I'm really powerful, and I'm informed enough to do something with that power and make a positive difference. So that's kind of where I stand, that's my hope. I think this is a great crowd because I think of you guys as being ahead of the curve. And so I'm honored to be addressing you, and I'm looking forward to watching the movement grow and to serving it as well as I can. I'm going to get a chair.
So we can do some Q&A and more.
So when you're thinking about strategic cost selection, presumably you're working within some framework or system of values. How did the organization arrive at that? Did the different researchers do some sort of identification of their system of values and converge that in some way?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely one of the weird things about GiveWell is it really is just an organization that's kind of based on where, or at least it's historically just been based on where Ellie and I would give our personal money to do as much good as possible. The people that have come on board have generally had enough in common with our values that it hasn't, like, this hasn't really been a problem. And I think, you know, a lot of what goes on is when you're being an effective altruist and you're looking broadly and you're looking at the facts, there's a lot of commonalities that emerge. But that is kind of how the values are determined. We did try to write up our values that in a blog post called something like Core Values and Worldview Characteristics, or Deep Values and Worldview Characteristics. And, you know, there's never been a point at which we kind of had a formal deliberation process to work out where we stand on every key question. I think basically, you know, the way this blog post came about, frankly, is I wrote down what I think, and then I sent it to everyone, and I was like, does anyone disagree with any of this? And there was some disagreement, and so we watered some of it down, because there's some philosophical questions that we're unsure about. And I think one of the characteristics of GiveWell is that we are always thinking in return on investment terms. And so if there's philosophical questions that we haven't resolved, there's always a question of how much time would it take to explore this philosophical question more deeply. What do we think we would get out of that time? And is there a better way to spend that time? Usually the answer to the last question is yes, in my opinion. And so, you know, there's a lot of deep philosophical questions that we have left unresolved at the time being, and we'll come back to them if and when sort of a decision between giving opportunities forces us to.
Yeah. So if you're moving from more traditional, easy to measure if you're moving from the most easy to measure causes, I think that's basically put aside from traditional GiveWell, to things that might be more speculative, GiveWell Labs, it seems like you're going to have to ask people to sort of trust your gut a lot more, because some of these are just either you're going to have to ask them to trust your gut, or you're going to have to come up with offense to that?
Well, I think we're already asking people to trust their gut a lot with traditional GiveWell. And I think that's an important thing not to miss. People who follow traditional GiveWell, along that chain from dollars to lives saved, there's just a lot of questions, and a lot of them we're kind of guessing at or we're using informed expert opinion at. Anyone who's really gone into the details of our cost effectiveness estimates can see that. It's not, there's no ironclad case that a certain number of dollars saves a life. We're doing our best, and we're publishing it for transparency and opposition. And then people who give to our top charities are also just making a judgment call that's the cause they're comfortable with, that they're not doing all the other different things they could be doing. So there's already a lot of that going on. I don't really have much of an answer, except that, again, we don't see our only mission as getting dollars to the things we think are good. We see the central mission, really, as just getting a more substantive, more intelligent discussion out there. And so we're trying to be a group that does the very best we can, finds where we would give to do the most good, explains why we would give there, and basically starts a discussion. And, I honestly can't predict when we do that if people are going to come apart much more than they do with our traditional charities, and everyone will be splintered, and no one will go along with all our judgments and want to do them. I don't know whether that's going to happen, but I certainly think, I would be more confident about the idea that this improves the quality of dialogue, the quality of information. This leads a lot of people to make more informed decisions than they would have otherwise.
Yeah.
Might I characterize what you just said as mission one, scale everything that's provable and scalable. Mission two, improve dialogue until you have higher standards such that your things become provable and scalable?
So I wouldn't, by the way, should I repeat the question when people ask these questions, or can everyone hear okay? Okay, so Michael asked, would I state the mission as kind of step one, scale everything that's proven and scalable. Step two, improve quality of discussion to the point where we can make currently non-proven scalable things into proven scalable things. We haven't actually scaled everything that's proven and scalable. We've identified it, but we haven't closed the funding gaps, and we're still moving on anyway. My personal take at this time, and I reserve the right to revise this, is that there's a lot of the best philanthropic interventions, they're not going to become proven. They're just not. And so you're going to have to use some other method to decide which ones to fund. And I'm happy to talk about what my feelings on that method are. But I even think that even the stuff that is most naturally a fit for being proven, there's still a lot of gaps in there. And there's a lot of stuff that's just a much worse fit for being proven. We're talking about, maybe a 10, 20-year attempt to build a set of organizations that can have kind of unpredictable effects on some political issue is a good example of this. I don't think that's going to become something where it's all proven like a drug is or something.
How much do you think that's the scalable stuff currently? You said it's not all done, but how's that compared to the resources
required? So Michael asked, how much room is there currently for scalable, proven, cost-effective interventions? In other words, how much money could you pour into the GiveWell One stuff? I think a lot. I know the bed net gap is hundreds of millions of dollars a year. That's just to cover everyone with bed nets that is living in, a malaria zone and that has kind of been determined to be eligible for free bed nets. That is usually the number that I remember, because that number is sufficient when we're talking about, we're putting it against the $10 million we moved last year. But if you start talking about getting cash transfers to every, extremely poor person in the developing world, that would be a much, much larger number. So it's a really big gap. But I don't believe that proven is a fundamental characteristic of good, of the best interventions. I think there's definitely reasons to believe it is. There's definitely good things about proven. It allows a level of accountability that you don't get with other things. It allows a level of honesty and objectivity and transparency that you don't get with other things. But, it's also kind of, because proven can be easy to see, it also does tend to attract money from other funders. There is a big gap for the proven stuff, but I don't know what to say, except that there's a lot of really high-risk, high-reward stuff that I think could be better than the proven stuff. We're not committed to turning everything into proven. We're committed to a better dialogue around how to do good.
Yeah. I have a couple questions about donating directly to GiveWell. Do you guys have capacity to grow the organization if we donate for more research? And the other question is, would it be possible for the EA community to pool resources by donating to GiveWell and have GiveWell donate to recommend the charities?
Right. So the question is, donating to GiveWell, could more donations to GiveWell help it directly by financing our expansion. It could help us indirectly by going to top charities and increasing that money move number. We're going to be on the first question. So one thing is that we generally don't solicit from the general public. And that's just something we don't do because it would create issues that we don't want to deal with and don't have to deal with. So the way that we work our fundraising is that we have kind of an inner circle of people who are big fans of GiveWell and who we feel kind of really get it. And whatever funding we feel we can productively use, we try to raise from them. And so far, that's worked. And it puts us in a good position because we have much more credibility when we can go out there and say, give here, instead of just going out to everyone and saying, give to us. That's a general rule. I mean, are we going to be raising money for ourselves? Do we need money? I think we still need to do some calculations around this, and we're going to be writing more about it because there's all kinds of things going on right now where we're looking at scaling up more than we have in the past. And I think that we're also, because we're working with good ventures, there's all kinds of questions about how much of that operating support should come from them. And we have to address those questions, I think, before we start asking for money. So we're going to be writing more about that. One thing that I definitely want to note, and I think this is a very broadly applicable issue, is that there's no shortcut to expanding capacity. There's no when you're hiring good people, it's like every person you hire, they're a risk, they're a long-term bet, they eat up your capacity in the short term. And then if you do it right, and if you pick the right person, they gain you capacity in the long term. I think a lot of people come to us saying, why don't you just buy more capacity? And I really feel in most areas, and especially in an area like GiveWell, where it's hard to tell from someone's resume whether they're a fit, you can't really just buy capacity. Sometimes you get opportunities to do it. And then when we get those opportunities, we take them. And we usually, I think, have a pretty tolerant view of saying, oh, all this is going to cost is money, let's do it. But most things cost more than money. Most things cost managerial capacity. Most things cost co-founder time, especially if they're unfamiliar territory, and that's a very limited resource. So, you know, our room for more funding is limited, like a lot of groups' room for more funding, and we try to be honest and transparent about it, and we'll be writing more about it. But, you know, at this time, we're not soliciting, and perhaps we'll determine that there's a need, but that's probably going to be a couple months from now, and then that'll be public. And if it's public, it'll be like public information that we're trying to raise this much. We still won't be like soliciting from the general public. In terms of the other question, money moved does help us a lot. When people give to our top charities and they tell us about it so we can track it, and usually we find a way to track it, that is helpful. I mean, that number is a key metric that people use to evaluate, is this group growing? How much money are they worth supporting? How much of my time are they worth? How important are they? And having access to people to talk to you and explain things to you is a really important resource for a philanthropist. Giving to our top charities is a huge help to us in terms of structuring it in fancy ways. I mean, to me, there's no need. To me, it's just we track the money move. The money move figure is our top line figure. That's the psychologically relevant figure. If someone wanted to say, well, I want to increase your money move, but I don't actually like your current charities, so I want to use a DAF or something or give to you and your market. I mean, we can do that stuff. But from our perspective, money moved is what matters.
John Baker.
How far away do you think we are from like a tipping point where charitable incentives change, so charities are actually incentivized by higher quality information, even if GiveWell isn't specifically recommending them?
So the question is, how far are we from a tipping point where charities are really incentivized to produce better information and to be more transparent, to do good things instead of bad things? I think we're really far from where I'd want to be. I think we're always on a continuum. There are other funders who, you know, certainly within a cause, there are other funders who care a great deal about evidence and transparency and substance. And those range from individuals to foundations. So I think charities have some reason now to be substantive. I think they're probably better than they were when we started GiveWell. I don't think they're a ton better. And I think it depends a lot on the charity. So one heuristic is a charity that the reason they have money is because they tell a good story and they have lots of casual people giving them $30 on a whim. Those charities tend to be less interested in kind of substance and transparency than charities that the reason they have money is that they're getting it from kind of big staffed funders who are really looking into them. My subjective impression is we've made some progress from where we were. I don't think we'd get the same kind of boggling reactions that we got back in 2007. I think that may have something to do with the tone of how the media covers charities. The media doesn't do the same thing it used to, where it just says the only thing that matters is overhead. So I think there have been changes. But I think we're really, really far from, from what I want. And I think it's hard to predict when that tipping point comes because I think peer pressure matters a lot in charity. So, you know, it's just hard to predict when something reaches critical mass. Let's see, how should I do this? You.
So you talked about the value of like self-skepticism and how easy it is to talk yourself into a story about why you're doing what you're doing without, you know, sort of critically examining that. And in the spirit of that, I wonder if you could be, you know, a little more pointed and give a concrete example of some of the, like you talked about, you see some mistakes being made in the effect of altruism in that spirit.
Do you want me to talk about default mistakes, or do you want to talk about effective altruism?
I guess I'm more interested in the movement as a whole. Because I feel like you talk very frankly about what's going on with GiveWell, and I think we can hear more about that. But like, you know, for us to be able to look at our own, you know, where we're investing our time and energy and money, try to make better decisions about that. I'm really very interested in hearing about that.
Right. So I have lots to say both about things that GiveWell has done wrong and things that I would like to see different in the effective altruism movement. On the first topic, I'll just say this. I mean, we have a mistakes button on the front page of our website, and we have annual reviews, and we have charity updates, and those are where we kind of put out the things that we think we've done wrong or our top charities have done wrong. So there's a lot of that. But I was asked more to talk about, I guess, critiques of the effective altruism movement. I don't know what everyone's doing and what they're working on, and so these are very kind of general, you know, off-the-cuff kind of feelings based on kind of maybe reading the Less Wrong front page mostly, I guess, and talking to people. And I guess I won't be comprehensive because I didn't make a list or anything. I'll just say two that really jumped to mind. So one, I kind of alluded to this before, but you know, I do disagree with certain things that I think that a lot of the effective altruists think are kind of obvious guiding principles that narrow down the set of causes you should work on right away. So, you know, I don't, for example, believe that the idea that existential risk is the most promising cause because of the argument made in Astronomical Waste. I don't think that's a good argument. I do think existential risk is a promising cause. And a lot of the global catastrophic risks are pretty high in our list. And I think one of the bigger reasons they're promising causes is that a lot of them don't have that many people working on them. And so to understand how good causes they are, you really want to understand more about who's working on them and what they're doing and what they're not doing. But to pick that area based on the kind of argument that people normally give, which has something to do with just, you know, how big the number is, theoretically, if... Yep.
Whether you disagree epistemically or values, like, are you counting eutalons differently or think that we're wrong about the number?
So I disagree epistemically. I disagree that given a high weight on far future humans, that this argument is established. And I think there's many problems with it, which I'm going to be writing more about, which I can talk about. But I think the consequence of this is basically that you have, you know, you have this thing I talked about before, which is a shortcut. And I just think if people in the effective altruism movement were just looking at all the things they could be doing and all the causes that matter and putting more weight on, hey, I have contacts or I have skills in this area, so I should be in this area, I think you'd get a lot more diversity and you'd be learning a lot more from each other. And I think that, you know, better things would be happening. Another thing which I think is related is I feel like people in the effective altruist community aren't doing as much as I would like to see in terms of just like doing stuff with relatively short feedback loops and kind of seeing how it goes. I know there's some of that going on, and I know it's improved, and I think that's great. And actually, I think one of the really positive things that I've seen since I started following is the self-improvement stuff, which isn't effective altruism. But I just think there's, you know, I think it's a really positive thing because I think people are taking a very tangible problem, and they're trying to work on it, and they're learning about learning, and they're learning about knowing, and they're learning about doing. And I think these are really important things. So I feel like by doing things that are maybe, you know, at GiveWell, we kind of bit off this chunk at the beginning of proven effective, scalable. That was because it had a shorter feedback loop. We'd like do this analysis, people would check the analysis, we would learn. And I feel like by running an organization and by operating within that framework, I've just gotten so much better at just like getting stuff done. just being efficient with my time, getting things accomplished that I intended to have accomplished, knowing what's going to be accomplishable, knowing what sort of person to listen to, et cetera, et cetera. And so I just, yeah, I mean, I think if basically if everyone in the effective altruism movement kind of went out and said, you know, every cause could be worth working on, not every single one, but, you know, almost every cause could be worth working on, where's an opening that I see? Where's something where I've kind of bumped in, like I bumped in with GiveWell. Where's something where I bumped into something where I could make a difference that other people couldn't make and where I'm going to learn from it over time and I'm going to see how it goes? I just think the rate of knowledge accumulation and self-improvement would be sufficiently better that even if you guys have picked the right set of causes to begin with, I think you still end up in a better place.
Can I ask you to expand on, like, what actually is, like, wrong as a question of fact, not values, about astronomical waste as we see it?
Sure. So the question is, what's wrong with astronomical waste? So this could potentially be a long conversation. I want to make sure.
Isn't there some kind of shortcut to your conclusion that you
can do this? Uh-huh. yeah. I mean. So I think I'll give a fairly brief answer, and I guess if people want to hear more about it, they can keep asking. I mean, I think I kind of have two categories of objection I'll just say astronomical waste to that essay. So one is just this idea of flow through effects. I think, you know, we've written about this. I believe that if you help people in whatever way, they help other people, those people help other people, and somewhere along the line you're increasing economic growth / innovation / empowerment. I think this improves the odds of a very bright future as opposed to a very dim future. And so I think once you start accounting for these effects, you realize that you haven't actually learned very much from talking about the importance of the far future. I wouldn't say you've learned nothing if you decide the far future is where all the Eudelons come from, but you kind of haven't learned very much. There's just like a lot of things that could be as good as the things one is working on, and to say they're not relies on arguments like, well, I believe I have at least a 10 to the negative 10 chance of getting this incredible outcome, which I just think are not very good arguments. And that leads into my second issue, which is that, you know, I think basically, there's some strain of the effective altruist movement that I think performs this strange maneuver wherein they reason from uncertainty about the probability of an outcome to kind of a bet on a lower bound of probability. In other words, people say, well, I don't know, and therefore to call this probability 10 to the negative 10 would be overconfident, and therefore the probability is at least 10 to the negative 10. And I think that chain of reasoning is wrong. And I think to explain what's wrong with it is something that would take a little while that I can try.
I have a much longer webpage on what's wrong with it if anyone wants to know.
Okay, good. But what you end up with is, you know, the way that I think about the situation instead is when we think about, let's say, the value of, you know, of the scenario in astronomical waste of saving the world is, let's say it's like 10 to the 28th human lives. The kind of impact we're going to have on that in percentage terms, I think instead of thinking of it as, well, it's at least some number because I'm not confident it's not another number is wrong. Instead, what you should think of it is, well, the percentage I'm going to impact that is somewhere between like 0 and 1%. It's somewhere in between those. And if you multiply that out, that means the expected value of engaging this in this area is somewhere between like 0 and 10 to the 28th lives. And that relates back to the posts I've written about Bayesian adjustments where basically, if you have an expected value calculation and all it's telling you is that your expected value is within an incredibly wide range, it's kind of like a horizontal probability distribution, and it really shouldn't affect what you think. And you know, to talk about what your prior should be and whether it should be normal and what else it could be and how that would affect the argument is stuff that I could engage in, and I think, you know, the high-level argument I would make is that when you have a horizontal probability distribution, it probably shouldn't affect what you think very much because you always have other sources of information and you always have other ways of thinking about a problem other than doing a back-of-the-envelope calculation. So, you know, the two issues. So between those two issues, I think people are, you know, you could unite them into one observation that you have an essay that doesn't really have any empirical research in it and yet is claiming a confident conclusion about what one should be working on. And I think that should strike people as fishy. I think you should figure out what you should be working on by looking very carefully at the world. If you find that you figured out what to work on without looking very carefully at the world, I think there's probably something wrong with what you did. And in this case, my theory is that it's a combination of those two things. Standing up person.
Yeah, I just have to say, I totally agree that it's a red flag. Like, if you're making a statement about the world and you're saying about the world that involves investigation of the world, like, red flag. But also, like, there are statements about the world that are mathematical. Like,
sure.
You know, 101 is prime, right? Or,
sure.
You know, like, basically someone proves a theorem. Like, you don't really need to look at the world that hard.
Sure. So there are statements you can be confident in without looking at the world that hard. But what I said was you have a conclusion about what you should work on, and that is different from a conclusion about the relationship of abstract entities. And I think this is an intuitive argument. I mean, I'm not claiming to be laying out a proof right here. But the thing I'm saying should strike you as fishy is that you know what to work on. You have a set of talents. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on in the world. What to work on is this question that clearly should have input from a lot of empirical contingent things. And if you reached it without empirical contingent things, that's what I think is fishy.
I'm sort of sorry to reply then, but from my perspective...
Eliezer, yes.
You just took, like, two giant shortcuts. Like, there's this very difficult cognitive problem of figuring out which things you do are going to have the largest, like, impact on a probability of an okay problem, maximum utilization of galaxies. Getting there is hard. And there was the shortcut where you can just take this, like, really easy to figure out stuff about how many lives you're saving from malaria, and that's your answer. It's a wonderful shortcut. And then, like, there was a second shortcut where there was some uncertainty about things that looked like they might affect the galaxy, and then all that, and that uncertainty was used to, like, blur everything out and, like, don't worry about that. Figure out what your talent is.
Right. So I don't think I'm intending to take either of those shortcuts. So there's an accusation that I took a shortcut that said, here's what's proven cost effective, boom, that's what's best. That's never what we did. I mean, that's never, you know, our website says these charities are proven cost effective, underfunded, and outstanding. I think that's true. You know, did we ever believe that we had established that they're the best giving opportunities? No. But we offered them up to the world as proven cost-effective, underfunded charities that were the best we'd been able to find so far. And I would say AMF is the best giving opportunity I know of today that I could write a check to today with the information state that I have, which is very much a work in progress. And there's always going to be an answer to that question. But, you know, that answer that I give now is the product of 6 years of hard work, and the answer I give next year will be the product of 7 years of hard work, and it may be different. The other shortcut that I believe I didn't take was by saying that just because there are flow-through effects, they all wash out, and we can kind of dismiss this question of how do we impact the future of humanity. I mean, I believe that it is legitimate to argue about what's going to affect the future of humanity, and if you find things that are kind of robust, that are observations, I think those things should affect you. So I didn't ever claim to be confidently dismissing this question by saying everything has flow-through effects, but these effects are not kind of addressed or dealt with in the arguments that I do see that are out there. And, you know, at this time, I kind of don't see a case that existential risk has some privileged position. Aubrey Gray.
Thank you. I mean, it's been 5 minutes, so that was a good check. I have a question about my move. So you explained how money moves.
Okay, money moves.
Yep. So you explained about the ways that you measure where to be sure of it. It seems to me that there's one additional way that you didn't mention that could be good evidence for money moves, that could be a real multiplier, a massive multiplier, which is to work with the charities you recommend to get them to collect money, to collect information on this.
Yeah, we have done that.
Does it not? Like, I mean, it seems to me that it would be a very
right.
rapid positive feedback loop, and it would like increase the you know, the relevance and influence of the good well really quickly and so on. So what does that?
Yeah. So the question: can we capture more money moved by talking to charities and getting them to record where donations come from? We do that. I mean, we generally our main way of getting money moved is by communicating with the donor because that's just better for us. Then we have more information. We understand where it's coming from, how it's broken down. There's all these issues. If a charity tells us about a gift, what are they allowed to tell us? Can we follow up with the person? So, you know, we're trying to get as much on the donor side as we can and capture that information mostly that way and get as much of it as we can. But yeah, I mean, one of the things we do is try to work with charities to get that information from their end too and reconcile it all. That's something we do. It works better with some charities than with others. You.
What do you think of the opportunities to teaching charities what's the knowledge required to actually become more effective?
Yeah. What do I think of teaching charities what's required to become more effective? It's not something that we focus on. So, you know, we, with all the stuff that we're doing, we just don't have the resources to essentially be consultants, and we're much more trying to change kind of funder behavior and therefore change incentives. I also think there's an argument that kind of, you know, you're going to get further by drawing new people into the sector or by rewarding different people than by taking the existing people and trying to change the way they operate. So it's not something that's a priority for us. I think if someone had a good plan for teaching charities how to do something better, I think, you know, that would be really cool, but it's just not our focus. Yeah.
So you mentioned that research is one of those things that you want to figure out if it's a cause that can be happening. You haven't we in this room for the last few days, we've been talking about a lot of different research opportunities, some of which may be underfunded and not.
Right.
Do you have a way of thinking about how do you compare research, how do you compare the future benefits of that, which are not anywhere near as easy to calculate as AMF
right.
dollars? How do you
yeah.
compare it, apples and oranges?
How do we compare the far benefit? Far future benefits of research, fundamental research, to the benefits of AMF. I mean, one answer is you can do your back of the envelope calculations, and we do. I mean, I think we're pretty committed to doing the best cost effectiveness analysis we can. I think we work harder on it than, you know, than any other group out there. But a lot of times it doesn't come out to something very helpful. You know, another thing we can do is we can just lay out all the information we have, lay out the best arguments we can, be as transparent as we can be, and say, okay, a lot of this is just a gut feeling, but you should make your judgment call with all the information and analysis and arguments in front of you. One kind of heuristic that I use for thinking about this stuff in a very preliminary way, because we haven't looked into it that much, is I think about kind of mentally assigning a score for how important something is and how much money is in it. And I'm looking for things that are just like, you know, 10 out of 10 importance, 1 out of 10 money in it. That's obviously like, if you had that plus robust cost effectiveness estimates, you'd want to use the latter and ignore the former. But if you kind of don't have anything robust, like that to me seems like a predictive algorithm where the inputs could actually be somewhat robust, and I would expect it to point the right way.
Given that there are bottlenecks to the thing, and that there's a lot of research that needs to be done, should the EA movement be looking for another Holden and Ellie to start up another GiveWell and start scaling up themselves?
Right. Should the EA movement be looking for another Holden and Ellie to start another GiveWell? I think so. I mean, that would be great. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, should it be the top priority? I don't know. But I mean, yeah, I think it would be great. That's what I think. Two.
Since one of your main emphases is to get money moved to what you think is, you know, the best charity or the best charity that you can find at the moment, if you find an answer that, say, existential risk is the most important thing that people can be donating to, I think for the average donor, that might be a less attractive answer because it's not something that can really, you know, get tangible, and it sounds, you know, it's like something that you could discuss at the convention with a bunch of, you know, people that are more involved with this rather than just, you know, donating to malaria. So are you concerned that the amount of money would decrease, and if so, do you have a marketing that would, you know, figure out a way to reach it better?
Right, so the question is, let's say we decide that the best cause is X, where X is some really unpopular, hard-to-sell cause. Do we have a plan for the fact that that might turn off a lot of our donors? Currently, we don't have a plan. I mean, currently, we really don't emphasize marketing. It's just not what we do. In some ways, I think that one of our best selling points, one of our best advertising points, is how bad we are at advertising. Our donors like that about us. They like that we just kind of, we tell them what we think is the best way to accomplish good. I think they kind of, a lot of people get a little bit of a personal kick or pride out of, you know, even a little bit of a tribal thing out of funding what other people are kind of too silly to fund. I certainly do. So, you know, I think that this isn't necessarily an issue for us. And it's kind of in our DNA that we just, we're more on the wonky side of things. We say what we think is the best way to accomplish good, and people can do with that what they will. And if someone is better at marketing than we are, and they say, well, I can't market this X risk thing, but I can market bed nets to save lives, then like more power to them. But I would basically say we're not going to water down our public communications. And, well, we're never going to water down our public communications. That's never going to happen. In terms of kind of looking for things we can sell, like multiplying sellability times importance, I think we wouldn't do that unless we kind of felt we had to. And I don't think we'll ever have to. That's it. Number three.
Amongst the charities and projects that we've looked at, what interesting properties have we found that correlate with goodness?
What interesting properties have we found that correlate with goodness among the projects we've looked into? Let's see. I mean, one common thing that we found with our organizations is we found people who just for one reason or another can't tell, like, just aren't the best marketers. And I don't actually believe that necessarily correlates with goodness. I think it more correlates with being a GiveWell recommended charity, because it correlates with simultaneously being good and having room for more funding. is that you're kind of not the best marketer, storyteller. I mean, you know, I think that's definitely a common pattern we've observed. I mean, there's also, you know, there's certainly an element to which we are more likely to recommend a charity if we're able to understand it, if we're able to get substantive information from it, and if we feel confident in the people running it, that we'll continue to get that information, et cetera. And so that does tend, I mean, the people who run our charities, I think, resemble effective altruists and frankly resemble us more than the average people who run charities. Again, I'm not saying this is a great predictor of charity quality. I'm more like owning up to it as a predictor of a GiveWell recommendation. And we're aware of it. It's not necessarily a bias we want to have, but it may be a bias that actually correlates with actual goodness, and it certainly correlates with goodness that we're able to detect. Question number four, is that what we're on?
Yeah.
Okay, number four.
So lots of attractive altruists are interested in animal ethics, and I was wondering if like what are the odds of GiveWell looking into animal ethics in the future? And I know that you expect animal charities to be some sort of high risk and difficult to quantify.
Yeah.
So does that qualify for a GiveWell Labs research project?
Yeah. So will we be looking into animal welfare, and does that fit into GiveWell Labs? So I do think animal welfare stuff is generally going to be high risk, difficult to quantify, long term, shot in the dark type stuff. I don't think there are things out there that are, you know, kind of AMF like in their cost effectiveness and provenness and straightforwardness for animal welfare. Are we going to look into the cause? Yeah, I think we're going to look into the cause. I mean, my co-founder is like really, really not excited about animal welfare in terms of like just his philosophical values. I'm maybe a little bit more moderate. And then we have employees who are much more interested in animal welfare. So I think there have been some things we've published that kind of implied like we're never touching it. But I think those have been more a function of the voice of the person writing them. And also maybe of what we thought at the time. I think we're going to look at animal welfare. That's going to be a very hard thing to compare to other things. I also frankly have the intuition that it's not going to be a great cause by most heuristics you'd be able to use, because it is kind of a cause that gets a lot of people fired up. It's like a really easy story to tell. And it, you know, it does attract it, at the same time as it's very shot in the dark. So it's not like I can point to these things like bed nets where there's a huge gap. And within the people trying to do the political advocacy, et cetera, it does, you know, I mean, a lot of the people I talk to about what the right political issues to work on, they're just like, man, like animals get like 100 times the attention that like poor Americans get. And, you know, that's kind of it's more the thing I'm noticing in that reaction is the feeling that those groups are, they don't have that hard a time attracting funds and attracting supporters. So I heuristically don't see it as likely to be the most promising cause, but there are some reasons to think that there may be aspects of animal welfare that are really promising, and so we'll be looking for them. You can follow up. This is your question.
Yeah. So it seems to be some kind of agreement in the, like, in effective animal activism, probably we all also can say something with that, the, like, cost-effective animal interventions seem to be underfunded compared to most of them. So
okay. Which interventions?
So, like, all animal charities in the U.S. are about $200 million, I think.
Uh-huh.
Perhaps that's not counting some other things you're thinking of. It seems like it's a lot smaller than development aid.
Well, you can't compare animal charities to development aid. A lot of development aid is just from governments. I also think that number is probably way low, but I may be wrong. And I also think that we're probably looking for a number lower than that substantially lower than that, within the category of like shot in the dark type stuff you could do. Like I think there's causes that are kind of very important and get a lot less funding than animal welfare. But I mean, this is really me speculating. This is something we haven't looked into at all. So I think I don't want to get too into that. We're going to look into it, and we'll look into it with open minds. Question number five.
So just trying to think of the. It seems like there's a potential death by meta issue here that I'm interested to hear how you speak to this.
Okay.
So one variation of this is if I have $1 billion and I want to donate this effectively and I look at GiveWell, I can see GiveWell's doing fantastic work by organizing all these charities, and I can think, well, actually, it looks like I can probably do very well instead of donating to any of these charities, donating to GiveWell.
Right.
It seems like there's kind of a spiral effect here where everyone donates to GiveWell and no one donates to any charities. That doesn't happen in practice, but
right.
Another variation of this would be if all the donations went through GiveWell to charities. It seems like there's a... it's not clear to me what the decision function would be to decide what percentage of the money GiveWell would choose to go to the charities versus improving GiveWell's process.
Right.
So I'm wondering if you could speak to that.
Sure. So how do I feel about the potential meta trap where, you know, instead of giving to GiveWell's charities, you should give to GiveWell. Instead of giving to GiveWell, you should give to MetaGiveWell, which is an organization I started that tries to raise awareness of GiveWell. I think each case should just be made on the merits. I mean, I think you can't. This again comes down to these kind of very non-robust theoretical arguments that I think should not be used as an intensive guide to action. So if the reasoning you're using to give to something is like, well, it seems like probably for every dollar they spend, they could raise more than $1 for their charities. Like that to me is like not really an argument. That's just like a wild guess that's uninformed. I think what, you know, if you look at each thing you could give to on the merits and you say, okay, you know, these guys will burn up 10% of my money doing X and then pass the rest along. Does that 10% add enough value to be worth it? I think you don't get stuck in a meta that way. As far as how much we take off the top if people give through us, I mean, GiveWell pretty much, our operating model is that we promote our top charities. If people give to us and ask us to give it to the top charities, we don't take anything out, except like bank processing fees or something. But we're not, you know, we're not taking that for ourselves. And then we separately determine how much we need to, you know, be as effective as possible. And we go to a certain set of donors and we say, you know, this mission is a better use of money than giving to our top charities. There's only so much room for dollars in this mission. You're one of the people that we're approaching to support this mission. So please support it.
Sure. As a specific example, it seems to me that you have not decided that the right thing for you to do is to quit GiveWell, earn money, and donate it to the malaria net.
Right.
Right. So that tells me that at some level you think that what you are currently doing is more valuable than the same marginal hours poured into that charity.
Yeah.
So...
But, okay, so I think what I'm doing is more valuable, where value is, just got to remember, a function of the person doing it as well as the thing that's being done, than earning money and giving to a top charity. And I think, you know, GiveWell, I think we wrote about this recently. I mean, GiveWell talks about money, and so we tend to be pretty universalist because everyone's dollars are kind of worth the same. But, you know, when you're talking about how to allocate your labor, a huge input is who you are, what you're good at, who you know, what your options are, and that varies incredibly across people. So, you know, I think what I'm doing is a better use of my talents than if I were to go back to the hedge fund and just earn as much as I could and give it to AMF. But I don't really see a danger of a regress there. Like, I think if someone here has an idea for a MetaGiveWell, like, that should be evaluated on the merits. The question should be, does this organization produce enough value with those dollars that it's better than giving to GiveWell? And, you know, currently I'm not aware of such a case. But, you know, if there were, then that would be fine. And that organization would have a certain amount of room for more money before that was no longer true. I guess I don't really see the trap. All right, I'm gonna do this numbers thing again. And this time I'm going to go from the right. One. Well, otherwise these people, okay. One, two, put your hand down when I call it, and then I'll know that you know. Three and four, you. And then your other hand is five. Okay, so you're four and five. Okay. No, that hand is four, Michael Vassar is five, and the other hand is six. And then you're a seven. You're a seven. Okay. You're eight. Okay. NC, sorry. Okay. All right, number one.
Did you look into like projects of the United Nations? Because to me it seems they are quite well funded and also like so well known that they can be picky about the people they choose, so I'd expect like a higher capacity of thinking there.
Yeah. Did we look into projects of the United Nations with the theory being that they're very well funded, they can pick their people? We've spent a lot of time talking to large organizations, to some extent to governments, although those are harder to talk to and harder to get on the record. We've talked to UNICEF a bunch. You know, big organizations are weird. I still really struggle with how to approach them because it is true that they can... a lot of great people want to work for big organizations, and a lot of great people end up at big organizations, but also, like, a lot of not great people end up at big organizations, and big organizations have, you know, it's hard to kind of keep the quality uniform, and it's hard to run those things, and so, and a lot of them are subject to political forces, so even if they have great people, they're often not doing great things. So I don't have much to say except that I have found the variation in people working at big organizations to just be huge. I think we've talked to people who are great. I think we've talked to people who are awful. We definitely think it's worth engaging with them. It's a way of knowing what's going on in the world, what people are working on, and, you know, we're open to working with them on projects. You know, one other issue is big organizations, they tend to be able to do the projects they find most valuable. And so, you know, where we would come in and how our dollars would make a difference tends to be somewhat questionable, and maybe that's why we haven't found any projects that have seemed that great to us so far. But we, you know, we talk to those organizations and we definitely look at them. I think they're worth engaging with.
And so do you suspect that they might have been something more beneficial but already got the funding they need?
Well, in some sense that's always true. I mean, in some sense there's certain things that are obviously more beneficial than what we do that are already funded. Just like, for example, I mean, providing like electricity in New York City or something. It's just like, well, you know, this obviously creates a lot of value and it's funded, and of course. So, I mean, I that's where the marginality and the room for more funding is really important. So, you know, I do think developing world governments, they do a lot of stuff that's really valuable, and it's just like so obviously valuable that they're funding it, and it's the first thing they fund. So, yeah, I think there's stuff like that, and that's why we always work on the margin. Question number two.
Yeah. So you mentioned using your skills and capacities as a heuristic for figuring out where you fit in. It seems like if it's the case that you can't gain important new skills and capacities, or that it's like really, you know, kind of you have this position and it's more set, then this is going to maybe be the dominating consideration. But it seems like maybe a shortcut to answering a way harder problem of what needs to happen.
Yeah, so the thought is, when I say use skills to decide what you should do, is that just a shortcut because it kind of presumes that skills are fixed? I guess it would be a shortcut if that were a bad presumption. I think to some degree skills tend to be fixed. And skills aren't just skills, they're also contacts, and they're also what you know and what you understand. You know, I think certainly people can improve at things. Certainly people can get good at things they weren't good at. I believe I've done a lot of that myself. But I also think there's limits to these things. And I think anyone who's looking at the world and saying, boy, like, I should spend all my time figuring out what job most needs to be done because I know I could get in a position to do that job and I know I would do it well, I think such a person, especially if they're not already pretty successful, is probably being overconfident. And I think along the way of getting that good and along the way of trying to get into that position, they'll probably change their mind anyway about what's really needed. So, I mean, my basic view is that observations about what you're cut out to do and about what opportunities you have to advance are just more robust observations than observations about what job theoretically needs to be done, which is very hard to understand in an analytical way from the outside. So, you know, when I talk about not taking shortcuts, I obviously don't mean don't ever set priorities or don't ever make decisions. But kind of, I'm always kind of trying to take the full set of information I have and make decisions that are mostly based on the more robust parts of it. So I don't, and I believe there is a theoretical justification for this, but, you know, I don't want to be taking things that I kind of, you know, I don't really know anything about this topic, and I haven't really understood it, and I'm wildly guessing at a bunch of the relevant parameters, and have that be the main thing driving my decisions. I like the things driving my decisions to be the things that I'm more sure of, and I think that's a justifiable approach. And in this case, choosing a career, you know, I'm more sure of, like, from where I sit and what I'm good at, what there is for me to do, than I am about like what theoretically could be done if I could just kind of swap with any person on Earth. Question number three. I'm going to lose track, by the way, so just correct me if I get it wrong.
Just to quickly follow up on this before I ask my actual question. It seems for a lot of us here on the creative front, there's just like quite a large number of options which we could do given our skill set and our contacts.
Right.
So there's still going to be a fairly question of how we choose among them. And then it seems sensible to try at least make the best guess about social impact.
Right.
What do you think?
So the question is, I mean, people have lots of options. Shouldn't they consider social impact and effective altruism considerations? I certainly think people should consider this stuff. I mean, I did an interview with 80,000 Hours where I kind of laid out my views on this. My basic feeling, I mean, certainly if you look at kind of what I've done and what I think a lot of the most effective people have done, and not that those are the same, but, you know, I think it's a pretty consistent pattern. And in terms of the advice I'd give to people, it's when you're starting off, you take the opportunities more based on personal development potential, potential to make contacts, potential to gain power and status and freedom, and then you go from there, and at a certain point, you will have these things, power, status, freedom, contacts, skills, and then you will see something that matches them. And so, for example, if you look what I did, I mean, I worked for whoever was kind of paying me the most and was the best environment to learn in about something. And I think I grew a lot as a person. I got a lot better at kind of most of the things that I wanted to be better at. I made contacts. I gained skills. I gained understandings. And then I bumped into this GiveWell idea. And I was like, wow, I'm really well positioned to do this. I can raise the money. I see the problem. I'm a customer of the problem, so I know it's a real problem. It's very easy to imagine a market inefficiency in an area you don't know well. But if you notice that you're trying to buy something and it doesn't exist, then you have a stronger sense that there's really a gap there. So that's kind of the formula. And I think that the more advanced you are in your career, the more sense it makes to start asking these questions. So for example, someone who was like a really killer like manager or salesperson, like that person I think should be thinking really hard about which company to work for and which company does the most good, because they know what they're good at and they know what their options are, and like a lot of the variation is driven by who's good. But I think early in your career, like the priority is just to kind of get bigger in some sense. Yeah, follow up. Sure, yeah.
So you suggested that currently you don't expect people to spend a lot of money on marketing. It seems that if you did spend more, your money would increase quite a lot because loads of people just don't know about people or recommended charities.
Uh-huh.
And it seems like one of your goals is to increase your money moved, but you hinted that you're worried it would hurt your brand. Do you think that how much it would hurt your brand would totally outweigh how much you could increase your money?
Right.
So I'm hearing the question is, why don't we spend more money on marketing? Because if we spent the money, it would produce a multiplier on money moved. The answer is there's almost nothing, especially in a startup environment, that just costs money. And good marketing is certainly not an exception to that. So if we thought we could just, you know, all it took was X dollars, and then we'd get some great marketing, and we thought that was probably going to raise, you know, Y dollars, where Y is greater than X, that would be a very different situation from what we're in. You know, it would take a ton of my time and my involvement to try to hire, you know, to try and buy marketing. You can't just buy it. And I can go more into why that is if you want, but that's basically the feeling, and I just think there's better ways to spend my time right now, and that may change in the future. You know, I can imagine a day where our research is not getting better much faster. It's kind of as good as it's going to get. And our money moved is really slowing down, and we need to juice it. Well, that would be a day when I would prioritize marketing, potentially. Today, I see our money moved growth is pretty strong, despite us not really marketing much. And our research just really needs to get a ton better before we can reach what I consider to be our potential. So that's where I'm focused. By the way, this particular topic, this is like the most common debate in GiveWell board meetings, and we post audio of our board meetings online. So if you're really interested in this topic, it'd be like watching the most boring TV show ever. Just like, listen to our board meetings. We have like 100 debates about this issue. Our board generally wants more marketing, and Ellie and I generally don't. So, question number four.
So you worked at Bridgewater for how long?
3 years.
Okay, so. The thing I'm curious about is, are there intellectual procedures or organizational procedures that you either A, like have
was this kind of, you worked at Bridgewater for 3 years. Have you brought kind of practices to GiveWell from it that you think other people should copy? So I'm just not going to talk about about Bridgewater at all. I'm not going to talk about what I learned there or anything like that, because that's, you know, Bridgewater, unlike GiveWell, it's a hedge fund. A lot of stuff is proprietary. They're not having a mission to share information with the world. So, you know, also I've been at GiveWell about twice as long as I was at Bridgewater. So to the extent that there's things that we think people should learn, I mean, they've evolved a lot, and we'll talk about those as just things that we believe that people should do. So, I mean, I think I've learned a lot about effective practices. A lot of what I've learned is probably more context dependent than it seems to me, and more dependent on the specific things we're doing. We do write about some of it. You know, there's certainly a lot. There's a lot we've written. There's a lot we could write. There's a lot that I hope we someday will write. I guess if I were to just, like, throw one thing out there now that I would say people need to be aware of and do a better job of, it's just understanding the importance and the difficulty of recruiting, hiring, evaluating, managing, and firing. That, I think, is something that, you know, with all the questions we get about why don't we buy this, why don't we buy that, why don't we spend money to do this, all those questions to me indicate that the person doesn't understand how hard these things are, how central they are, how important they are. And I think within the effective altruism movement, I see a lot of emphasis on problems and solutions and interventions without paying enough attention, I think, to organizations and people. So, I mean, in my opinion, like, if you have the best idea in the world and you hire a person to do it who's, like, pretty good, you fail, pretty much guaranteed. And if you have, like, a crappy idea and you hire an awesome person to do it, usually, like, something really good happens that's, like, not even, like, you know, it's better than what you would have hoped for with your crappy idea. And so I think being able to, like, find the right people, pick them, train them, cut off the relationship when it's not working. I mean, it's very hard to get anything done without being able to do this. I really wish I was better at it. If I could be better at one thing, I would pick this in a heartbeat. And it is like, you know, I think a lot of people envision, well, if only we had more money, we could do blah. But usually the bigger deal than money is people. And so if people were better at that, I mean, if I were better at that, I think GiveWell would be doing a lot better. I think it's a huge thing holding us back. And I think a lot of people just don't recognize it. And so they don't put enough effort into it, enough thought into it. And, you know, we've learned that it just has to be a huge priority for us. It has to be a huge part of the way we spend our time. And when we bring someone on, we've got to get right into evaluating them, learning their strengths and weaknesses, deciding whether they should stay with us, deciding what they should be working on that fits them. That just has to be where our time is going. And we can't just kind of, you know, treat that as a side point. It's kind of the most central point. Question 5.
Okay.
Michael.
So
yeah.
What was the historical curve in your current current estimate in the effectiveness of the world trade? So initially, you were interested in village reach and stuff,
right,
and process, and maybe something else before that. Every year things have changed. What is the, like, is it an exponential growth curve? Is it moving towards an asymptote? And also, how have your estimates for how effective previous charities were changed?
So how has the curve of GiveWell's charity's effectiveness historically looked? Is it exponential? Is it linear? What do I think of our past charities? So I don't know what exact shape it has. I'm sure it's not linear. I think it's closer to exponential. I really think for our first, like, 3 years, we were almost kind of making wild guesses. And I think when I look back at those charities, I think they're fine, but, you know, I don't really necessarily believe that what we were saying was very, you know, liable, or that those charities were like outstanding effectiveness. Let's just be totally clear here. I mean, we were trying the best we could, and we believed everything we said. It's looking back that I think we just didn't know enough. We didn't have enough context. We didn't know what we didn't know. And I don't put a lot of weight on kind of conclusions we reach in those first 3 years. I think 3 years is about how long it took to kind of pick an area to be in, which was kind of the global health, global poverty area, which, you know, was picked because it's the best fit for this evidence framework, and kind of get to know it well enough that what we were saying really meant something. I think the money given to Village Reach, I think it's hard to say it had much positive, or no, I mean, I'm not going to say that. I'm not confident that it had much positive effect, because I think we've revisited their pilot project, and I think their project kind of got discontinued, and there's various like happenstance things that I think didn't go very well. But I think the expected value of Village Reach was high. I think we recommended Village Reach as kind of a guess, but after a year after we recommended Village Reach, and the first year we really got money to them in 2010, I think our recommendation was actually pretty well grounded. And if you brought to me an opportunity like that today, I'd be like, wow, this is pretty good. It's a group that really was attacking what is, by consensus, one of the most important problems in global health, which is health system strengthening. They had really some of the best self-evaluation we've ever seen, showing an impact, although, you know, self-evaluation is really hard to do well. And they really couldn't raise more money to scale up in what seemed to be a very logical thing to do. I think the scale-up didn't work out the way we hoped, but, I mean, we knew it might not work out the way we hoped. So I think that was a pretty good recommendation. The recommendation after Village Reach was AMF, and I feel good about AMF. So I think AMF is like the real deal, obviously. I think it's like pretty much what we say it is. I do think that by taking away the restrictions, I believe we're going to find much better giving opportunities. But I'm not 100% sure of that, because we're certainly getting away from proven and into speculative, and I think it's somewhat possible. I think conventional wisdom in philanthropy is that speculative and risky is where all the action is, but I'm just not totally sure that conventional wisdom is well-grounded, so I'm not really sure where we're going to go. But my intuition is we're going to do a lot better. Question 5.
I'm going to give you two and choose whichever one you think is going to be interesting.
Okay.
So question 1 is, given your experience, do you have a position about the overall sort of effectiveness or competence of these top charities as compared to what you could maybe imagine if you had, people with better motivation or, stronger work ethic or something? Maybe you could compare the effectiveness of these organizations in terms of the amount of optimization power to, if they're for-profit motivation styles, but doing that actively. That's the first question. Second question is, do you have a position on the effectiveness of evaluating nonprofit entities and recommending donations as opposed to evaluating for-profit, maybe startups, and making recommendations to ideological VCs?
Right, okay. Question 1, and I've been told to pick the question. So question...
I mean, you can answer them both if you think they both have interesting answers.
Yeah. I think it's easier for me to answer them both than to think about which one I'd rather answer. So question one, how do I think our current top charities compare to kind of an idealized version of those top charities? And question 2, have we thought about evaluating for-profits as opposed to nonprofits and telling ideological investors where to invest? So question 1, I'm not sure exactly how to answer this. I think our top 2 charities, for what they do, are really good. I think that the people running them are like people that that I feel really good about working with, and who I feel like, everyone has different strengths and weaknesses. So, I mean, are these people sort of people I'd want on my team for any given arbitrary task, or even on my team for running GiveWell? Well, no, but I mean, are they people that I would choose to do what they're doing? Yeah, I mean, they're really into it. They're really excited about it. They're really smart. They really genuinely believe in transparency. They're really there to do it as well as possible. So I guess I don't have complaints. I mean, I guess to the extent I do, I mean, I mean, in both cases, oddly enough, with number 1 and number 2, it's kind of they've not been super ambitious about kind of just like hiring staff, and I'm not sure why that is. I don't know whether I think it's kind of at the point where these people seem good enough to me that any disagreement I have with them is as likely to be my problem as their problem. So I guess that's how I'd answer that question. On the other question, do we recommend for-profits? Yeah, I think that's something we're not going to do anytime soon. So, one answer to this is that we're still in some sense biting off what we can chew. We're still in some sense limiting ourselves somewhat arbitrarily by looking at nonprofit. But I also think this is a good decision, because I think the for-profit ecosystem is so different. Because there's a whole different set of reasons that people would have to come in and give money to these things other than doing good. And so, it's just something that I think there's way more people who get excited about that thing, making money, than there's people who get excited about doing good. And when I compare our relative standing, I think compared to other people trying to do good, I think that we've got more, of certain things like transparency and breadth. And self-skepticism and some combination of them. Compared to people trying to make money, I don't feel as much that way. So I think that's an area we're pretty much not going. I'm not going to rule it out. Question 3.
Thank you.
Question six? Are we on six?
So I think one of the biggest differences in attitude that I noticed between Gibwell and many other people in this room, particularly about the research, is the degree of belief in altruistic life efficiency and how easy it is to be the best. For example, earlier today, Jeff was talking about the leverage plan, and the attitude seemed to be that the fact that something isn't being done is almost no evidence that you could do it and do it pretty well,
right,
or no evidence it's not worth doing. And it's reasonably easy to do research that thinks the best stuff that's out there.
Right.
And I know Gibwell's kind of skeptical about that. So I'd be curious to know whether you've kind of threshed that out with Jeff or with other people.
Yeah, so what do I think about broad market efficiency, and do I think it's true that kind of, you know, the market's totally, the altruism market's totally inefficient, and, you know, the fact that something's not being done tells you nothing about how good it is? I mean, no, I think the altruistic market is a lot more efficient than that. I think it's a lot less efficient than the for-profit market, depending on which part of it you're looking at. But, you know, I think it's hard to find outstanding giving opportunities that aren't already taken. It's not hard in the same sense as finding like ways to beat the financial markets. I think, you know, to beat the financial markets, it's like you have to be kind of just a really amazing in a lot of ways, including your interest in markets and including the amount of time you spend on markets and including your access to information and your insight and all that stuff. And I think, you know, I think to beat the altruistic market, I guess my rough intuition is that you have to be like, you have to try really hard for a really long time and be smart, which is, to me, a much lower bar than beating the financial markets. So that's kind of where I see it. But I certainly think you have to try really hard for a long time. I think I would not be comfortable recommending a project in an area that I just don't know much about. I want to have a basic sense that I've heard all the perspectives, I've talked to all the people, I've looked for the people who might be doing this project, who might fund it, I've heard what they have to say, I kind of know the space, I know what the different perspectives are, and I've really looked. And I think I've seen again and again that we have some idea that seems logically like no one should be working on it. And I can tell you 1,000 stories about why no one would work on this even though it were good, but it turns out someone's working on it. And there's all kinds of reasons for that. A lot of times something that helps the world also helps a particular group of people that you hadn't actually thought of. And that group of people is very interested in getting this thing to happen. So that's one aspect of it. And another aspect is like a lot of times it only takes one person. It only takes one person to run into a problem and say, wow, this problem's really important, and then raise a flag to another person who just happens to have a lot of money. And so, you know, you can have a real scarcity of effective altruists, but it's still not easy to just take a cause and say this cause is empty. And in fact, I don't think we've found a cause that's empty. I mean, I just don't think it's happened. And we've looked at a lot, and we've looked at a lot of causes. So any cause that's completely empty, I think, that we found, I think has basically been for good reason. So I think the broad market is fairly efficient. We wrote a blog post called Broad Market Efficiency where we laid out a lot of our observations. So I think we've put some of our evidence out there. I think counter evidence would be people, you know, finding things that are really awesome that aren't being done. I don't feel there's been such counter evidence. I don't think a lot of kind of uninformed generalists have come to me with ideas that turn out to be great. On further inspection. So that's where I stand, and I encourage people to read our post and weigh in.
One type of charity I see lots of advertisements for is cancer research or like research to cure X disease. I see a lot of that, so it seems like it's like there's a lot of funding going towards it, but it also seems like disease research is potentially like one of the highest impact things you do just historically.
Right.
Like to what extent have you looked into that? To what have you done like a first pass at like what are all the diseases that kill the most people that like look the most solvable that are
right,
most underfunded? Stuff like that.
Sure. So the question is, what do we think of cancer research and disease research? Lots of funding. It's very popular, but also it could have huge impacts. So I agree with both these things. I think it is very popular. There is a lot of money, especially in cancer. And I agree it could have really enormous impacts. I'm only going to give very informal beginning impressions here because I've basically been exploring this area for maybe like a couple months with the help of, you know, basically an informal scientific advisor, Dario Amadei, who, you know, is a postdoc at Stanford in biology, and a lot of what I think has come from conversations with him. We've talked to a few big funders and gotten their perspectives. My basic sense is, A, the ROI in medical research is probably really good. The return on investment of basic scientific research is probably really good, but I'm not sure, and I think the research on it probably could be improved, and we may work on something to do better. B, I think pouring money into cancer research, traditional cancer research, I think is unlikely to be the best way within science. C, you know, could you look at all the diseases and look at not only how much they affect people, but also how tractable they are scientifically and how much money is in them and pick the best ones to invest in? I think you could. I think we may. I think we may. And I think you would find things that are better than cancer. And preliminarily, I think, you know, aging is one of the things that I would look at as being, you know, promising within that framework. But I also, like, have an intuition that even that way of looking at the problem is actually probably not the right way to look at the problem if you want the very most impact, because you can slice the scientific world in a lot of ways. And the natural way to slice it, if you're not a scientist, is by disease. That's what people care about. But that's exactly the issue, is that if you are a scientist, there's other ways to slice the scientific world. And when everyone is interested in a particular disease, there's other stuff that falls through the cracks. So one of the theories that I've heard repeated from multiple places that I think is really interesting is that if you draw a pipeline of medical research, there's very fundamental, very high-risk stuff where no one knows what the applications are. This is like building tools that, you know, help you better measure things in the body, and you don't even know what you're going to use them for, really. Then you have kind of basic research that's applied to particular diseases. Then you have this kind of translational research that is trying to get stuff ready for industry, and then you have industry research. And the theory that I've heard is that there's a lot of industry research, and there's a lot of research in that kind of middle ground of academic work on specific diseases. But the very fundamental stuff, and also potentially some of the translational stuff, is where more is needed. So I've heard that theory a bunch of times. I think the translational part is probably more debated than the basic part. And that's the kind of thing I'm looking for in science, is just like, you know, what are the distinctions that you can't even see if you haven't looked into this field really hard? Because those are the ones that I think people are even more likely to be missing in a big way.
It seemed like maybe this was not going to be the best, most impact thing, but it seemed plausible that it might be a easier to evaluate to be able to impact it.
You mean cancer research specific?
Well, not cancer research specific, more of the, like, looking at diseases that are under.
Yeah, but I think right now we're trying to build a pretty good picture of scientific research and really look for the not only the most underfunded slice, but the right way to slice it so that you get the most important slice. I'm not sure that's by disease, but it might be. So, okay, more questions?
Finish your first batch.
Yeah, that was my second batch.
Yeah, so we have time for about one more batch.
Okay, one more batch. That sounds good. Unless we're just out. I've answered every question anyone could have. Okay, we've got one.
Okay, and you talked about, like, you think the astronomical waste argument is, like, just too far out there. On the other hand, like, research projects need a longer time scale to focus on, like, the most fundamental research. What do you think is a good time frame to look at the impact?
Okay, so I should clarify what I said. So the question is, what do I think is a good time frame to look at impact? And the short answer would be, you know, probably something short of 20 years is, like, my intuition of where we can, like, make pretty helpful predictions. You know, beyond that, it gets really hard. But it depends. Like, there's certain things that we have enough science to forecast out past 20 years. I guess, and that was really off the cuff, and I would probably give a different number if you asked me a different day. So I don't want to be tied to a particular time scale. And I want to clarify, the astronomical waste objection is not an objection about time scale. I think the way that I would put what I see as a large difference between me and some other effective altruists is that I think a lot of other effective altruists, the way that they go about estimating the expected utility of an action is they write an equation that has a lot of variables in it, and then they take their best guess at each variable, and then they execute the equation, and that's their midpoint, and then they say, okay, here's my expected utility. And I think the way that I do it, or try to do it, and the way I think it should be done, is that you pattern match an action to as many patterns as you can, and you take as many outside views as you can, and each outside view and each pattern gives you a different picture of what you should expect the utility to be and how valuable you should expect the action to be. And then you think about it in a whole bunch of different ways, and you produce a whole lot of different kinds of evidence, and no one line of evidence or no one framework or no one argument is knockdown, but you look for things where you have a lot of different lines of investigation pointing the same way, and you have a lot of reasons to think things, or you have a few robust reasons. And when you put all those models together, that's how you get your expected utility. And I think it leads to different results. So, you know, that's kind of, I think that is a better way. I think the problem with this way is it's much harder to make transparent. Because I think, honestly, I think that a lot of people who are really good at making predictions, they make a prediction by, like, comparing to, like, 1,000 different reference classes at once. And if you ask them to explain why they made the prediction they did, they can't even do it. They don't even know what they just did. And they'll pick one reference class, and they'll say it, and it'll sound really stupid because it's one out of 1,000. And so, you know, I think that is, like... But, and so that's the frustrating part about it, is it's much harder to make transparent. But I think we're looking for giving opportunities where we can say, okay, you know, we looked at this from a lot of different angles, and a bunch of the angles are pretty compelling, and there's a whole bunch of them, rather than, like, we fit everything into one framework. And so we're basically looking for kind of more robust recommendations, even if they don't always follow the exact kind of language that we hope they would follow, which is kind of the language of here's an expected utility equation. I don't know if that answered the question, but that was something I wanted to say, so hey. Now we've got a lot more questions.
There's a word for that. It's called Bayesian model average.
Right, yeah.
So, sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, I think so. Okay, I went right to left. So, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
One.
Yeah.
I can't remember when I've heard someone say as many interesting, fairly original things that I agree with in rapid succession as the last afternoon. Doing my sort of casual back to the envelope intuition, it looks like if all of the different points that you made today could be kind of codified and formalized and learned in the way that, you know, in the way that you know them, and I have no idea whether that's at all feasible.
Uh-huh.
Like, I don't know how much of what you said can be heard by someone who doesn't already agree with it.
Uh-huh.
That sounds casually crazy higher EV than I've heard of people actually doing in a formal manner. I don't even have requests for proposals for how we would go about communicating the different things that I thought I heard.
Okay.
But I'd like to know whether you have any thoughts about that and whether you would spend some time on that.
Is the comment you want me to communicate the things that I've said more widely?
Well, no, I want you to communicate them to the people who are right here, right now, in a way that actually leads to them understanding what you were thinking and how you thought and why you thought it. I have no idea how to do that. But
no, neither do I. No, I mean, I have no idea. I mean, I've tried, and I've also learned a lot from, you know, over the years I've tried, and I've written things... I've seen, well, hang on.
Not later, like not now.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
This is a communicable idea.
Okay, great. Yeah, no, I mean, I've written things, I've seen what comes back, I've written other things, and it's often been bumped down by other stuff on my list, but, you know, I mean, and I've learned a lot from the process, too, and refined my ideas a lot, so, yeah, I mean, a lot of this epistemology stuff I think is really interesting. I'm planning to write about it more, and people who have ideas for how to get clearer or just feedback on what I'm saying, yeah, I'm definitely into it.
You had just mentioned that, like, the best forecasters you know seem to have, your impression is that they have, like, 1,000 different reference classes and they sort of average them. I'm just curious, name a couple of forecasters that did that you respect.
Well, it really depends on the, it's just, like, different people for every domain. You know, one person who does it very explicitly is Nate Silver. I mean, if you look at his model, it's just, like, all this stuff that, like, by itself wouldn't be very good. And he just, like, you know, because there's so much stuff, it kind of gets good results. You know, I think the people at the hedge fund I used to work at, like, I think of them as, like, really crazy good at, like, making certain kinds of predictions and arguments. And unusually good at explaining them, but just not, they don't explain them in a way that would really be satisfying to someone who works in the traditional framework. I don't know. I'd have to think about that more. I mean, you pick a domain and I would think about it, but it's hard. Yeah.
What are we on? Three?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was going to ask a pretty similar question, or just, like, can you give an example? And you said this is, like, hard to make transparent, but can you give an example of, like, how, can you like, map that onto, like, a prediction that you made with this kind of that you don't think would have?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I'll, I mean, I think nothing good enough is coming to mind that I just want to spit it out. But I could give like a class of things, which is just kind of there are definitely decisions I've made where I've just been like, you know, every specific way I can imagine this playing out points to choice A. But man, like the person I'd be betting on is just like a person I don't feel good about. Slash, like, I don't think if, you know, I think this breaks like some very robust heuristics, like be honest and be good and, you know, interact with people well and like don't spend time on things you're not interested in and stuff like that that have worked well for me throughout the years. And then, you know, I make choice B and then like in some way that I could have never envisioned it turns out to be the right choice. So that's kind of the class of things where I wish I had examples that I could think of off the top of my head, but I think it's a very interesting phenomenon and one worth noting when like every specific scenario you can imagine that seems plausible points one way and yet your heuristics point another way and then watching and seeing what happens and how often the second choice is actually the right one for some scenario you couldn't have envisioned. That probably wasn't very helpful. Okay, number four. Yeah.
I had Michael's question, but I'd like to ask it from another angle if you have the same thing.
Okay.
What does GiveWell training look like? Where's the training program? What are your thoughts on how to train?
So the GiveWell training program, you know, a lot of the GiveWell training program is just knowing what we want people to do and what we expect them to do and making sure that we clearly communicate what that is and that we evaluate them really early on. So that's not very exciting because I think a lot of the stuff that is most important is stuff that we don't know how to tell people how to do it. And so they pick it up by immersion. And so a lot of what we do at GiveWell in training is that, you know, we need to have someone who can do something that's really valuable to us. They need to be able to do that. And if they can do that, then they can kind of like, then they're adding enough value to kind of justify their seat at the table. And by being at the table, they have this kind of difficult to quantify upside. And so that's a lot of our approach. And someone for whom there's nothing we need done that is valuable and they can do it, that's like a really bad sign and that's a good relationship to end. And someone who can do something that's really valuable and they can do it well, usually those people, it's like you just keep them around and they pick up other things that are hard to predict. So that's a quick answer on how we train people. I know that like two people who've worked at GiveWell, Nick Beckstead and Jonah Sinek, are both very much in this crowd and have done like a lot of reflecting on like what they learned at GiveWell and how they learned it. So they might be better people to talk to than me because I never got the GiveWell training.
All right, question five.
Can you try and give a prediction about the future state of the world in, say, 5 to 10 years where everything goes right? Say, GiveWell grows exponentially and the effective altruism movement becomes mainstream?
Yeah, an optimistic prediction about the future of the effective altruism world in 10 years. I mean, we're here in Silicon Valley where a lot of people, not here, but, you know, we're in San Francisco, we're near Silicon Valley, where a lot of people are getting rich very suddenly and wondering about what to do with it. And I think, you know, the best case scenario is that we kind of, we're making our case and a critical mass of those people, it appeals to them. Whether that's because of aggressive marketing or whether that's because it's just out there. And then when the critical mass hits, it becomes like the cool way to do philanthropy and to some extent the cool thing to do. And once you have that, once something has the image of being like, this is what smart, thoughtful people do with their giving or just period, then it becomes like extremely widespread, at least in Silicon Valley and maybe across philanthropy as a whole. And then, you know, you have the beginnings of a much more developed, mature philanthropic sector where it's considered an important thing that everyone is kind of debating and studying how to do good philanthropy. And so you have a lot of money going into history of philanthropy and a lot of money going into philanthropic analysis and a lot of foundations who work in different fields getting together to debate and lay out what they think. So that's what I think. I think that process of really pouring resources into better debate and analysis could be beginning in 10 years as you get the domino effect with lots and lots of people thinking this is the right way to give. Question number six? Okay.
Who's number six?
We only got to five.
Oh, did we? Okay, cool.
We still have time for a couple more.
Two more. There's one. Okay, there's two. Yeah.
Can you talk about hiring, how you make hiring decisions and what you look for? And maybe is there anything that lessons that you can take to a different organization that aren't idiosyncratic?
Yeah, can I talk about hiring decisions and how to do it? I mean, one thing we've learned that I think is actually pretty generalizable, and I think for some reason a lot of organizations have been kind of learning it at the same time, is how bad interviews are as a predictive tool. They're terrible. And resumes are really bad, too, especially if you're hiring for generalist roles. And so where does that leave you? And it's a real question. I think what we have been doing more of, and I've also noticed more like startups doing more of, is trial hires. So a lot of what we do now is we kind of, you know, we get an initial read on someone, and if we have space for them, and if we think they're pretty good compared to our other options, we're just like, all right, what can you do for us in terms of a trial hire? You know, come in 2 days a week. There was one guy who was working for us like 1 day a week. There's, you know, another person who came in for like, well, there's a lot of people who will like come in for a summer. Just like, what can you do so that we can just work with you? I think that's a better way of doing it. Another thing that we I think have been learning and also hearing from other companies is that referrals are really important. I think we underestimate the extent to which we're looking for people who resemble us. What seems to us like people who are smart and have common sense and are competent often means people who think like we do. And so I think the result is that, you know, referrals account for a higher percentage of good hires than one expects. And I think this is a robust observation across a lot of different companies. So one of the things we've been talking about recently is like, you know, can we dial back the efforts at on-campus recruiting and job postings and just try harder to think about which of our friends might know people and how we can go really press them for referrals.
Oh, yeah, there was. Sorry.
Yeah. Could you maybe talk a bit more about, like, what sorts of standards the kind of, like, less proven giving opportunities that labs are looking into would have to, like, meet in order to kind of be making, like, concrete recommendations?
Yeah. What sort of standards would a less proven giving opportunity have to meet? So, you know, there's one thing. Comparing a less proven to a more proven is really hard. We're going to try with back-of-the-envelope estimates and all, but I think a lot of that's just going to be kind of gut and judgment call. But in terms of comparing less proven to each other, I think we want to see that there's less attention in an area and less money than there should be given the importance of an area. And I think we want to see that the people behind them are like impressive and qualified and have good track records or have good qualifications to do what they're doing. And I think a lot of it's just comparative. A lot of it's just looking at, you know, well, this bet has about the same upside as that other bet, but, you know, there's way less effort going into it. So let's find the best thing we can do that's working toward this goal and measure it by kind of, you know, some of it's triangulating expert opinion. Some of it is taking what the experts say and testing it with the empirical data to the extent we can, and just trying to build a coherent picture of kind of who knows what they're talking about, which kinds of inquiry have a good track record, and what are the unproven opportunities that kind of fit a lot of heuristics of things that have worked before. So I guess that was a kind of rambly answer. I think it's largely a work in progress. But I think the science thing that I was talking about is a good example of what I mean, where what you want to do is you want to collect all the different perspectives on how to slice science and how to find the most proven thing. And then you take the reasons people are giving for why their thing is the most important thing, and you try to compare those to reality. Not because you're trying to get a full cost-effectiveness estimate that maybe can't be done, but you can take things people say and you can say, are these things true? You can ask people why they disagree and find the points of disagreement that can be tested and test them. And then you can hone in on something that's a combination of triangulating expert opinion and also testing expert opinion against each other. And I think that may get you somewhere. And then you can look at how it resembles things that happened in the past that went really well and how it resembles things that went poorly.
Is there another example of like another cause area or something like the labs are doing at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're just not far enough along. I mean, we don't have anything where I would say, this is it. This is a great opportunity.
Yeah. Kind of like within this area, like this is what we would be looking for.
Well, I kind of said what we would do within science. I mean, I think that is the best example because that's what I've been thinking about recently. You know, I've also been thinking a lot about political advocacy. So, you know, I've been thinking you could take all these issues that may have humanitarian significance and you want to take each issue and you want to say, A, you know, what's a bill that might actually get passed in the next 10 years, and how important would it be in some sort of humanitarian terms? And then B, who's working on this issue, right? And how many people and how many dollars? And you're looking for mismatches. Do we have time for more questions? Are we done? Okay, one more.
So it seems like you spoke a bit
Okay, so how do we investigate a new area? What are the key components? I mean, it's a work in progress. And a lot of what I say, you know, we're doing a medium depth investigation because we want to learn from it and say, did we get something that we think, you know, helps us decide or not? And do we, you know, has this shifted our views or not? But right now, I would say the big questions are, how important is the problem? How tractable is the problem? I.e., are there ideas out there for what to do that could plausibly work? And then the thing we're putting the most effort into is how crowded is the space. That's something where you can do a lot of investigation and you can learn who works on what, and it's very empirical, and it tells you where the gaps are.
All right.
Excellent. So, Holden, I think it's been a really excellent conversation.
Thanks.
I really appreciate you taking the time, and I certainly understand Gibwell much in a different way than I did before.
Good.
That's great.
Good.
And I think that the comments you've made will probably be useful to some of these people in this crowd. I've been thinking throughout the questions just now if there are things that these people can do to help you and Gibwell, and I have three suggestions. They're just suggestions.
Okay.
So one is we're taking high-quality video of this talk. If you want to use it to try to give other people that understanding of Gibwell, and maybe that would be useful, that would be excellent. Two,
okay.
I think it's maybe possible to buy marketing. I think Michael has a good relationship with someone who can sell it to you. So I think you should talk to him about that.
Okay.
Maybe when you have the money, that would be a good option. And then three, so as a disclaimer, I generally have a distaste for people sort of jumping on bandwagons and doing things without thinking. So that's not what I'm saying here. But I'm going to recommend a crowdsourcing operation. For the Gibwell Labs thing, it seems like one problem you're going to face is just this initial, like, generating a big list of things to do the quick five-minute thoughts on.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of people here who spend a bunch of time thinking about all the speculative causes.
Yeah.
If you made, you know, a Google form or circulated email and got suggestions from these people, you might get one or two things you never thought of.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
And so I'd say we should do that.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, it'd be cool if you guys put something together like that.
Great.
We'd
all right.
Love it.
Holden Karnowski.
Cool.